Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to the EAN podcast on the EAN Peripheral Nerve Society guideline on the diagnosis and treatment of CIDP. My name is Panayotis Zis, and I'm an assistant professor of neurology and clinical neurophysiology at the University of Cyprus. And it is my pleasure today to have with us Professor Van den Berg, professor emeritus of neurology at the University of Leuven, a past chair of the Inflammatory Neuropathy Consortium of the Peripheral Nerve Society, chair of the Peripheral Nerve Society Guidelines Committee, and a member of the GBS-ICIDP Foundation Center of Excellence. Professor Van den Berg, thank you for being today with us.
Thank you, Takis, for this nice introduction.
So many of our listeners are aware of the 10th version of the EAN Peripheral Nerve Society guideline on diagnosis and treatment of the CIDP. And a couple of years ago, a new guideline has been in place for the diagnosis and treatment of CIDP. May I ask, why did your team decide to update the existing guideline?
The first version of the guideline was published in 2005, and the first revision in 2010, and that's already more than 10 years ago. Both were EFNS, PNS guidelines. The second revision was absolutely necessary because significant progress in clinical and basic research is leading to a better understanding and treatment of CIDP. And now this has become an EAN-PNS guideline. I would like to emphasize that misdiagnosis of CIDP is common and that this mainly occurs in CIDP forms other than typical CIDP. Clinical research has shown that there are four main pitfalls. One, clinical criteria and differential diagnostic exclusions are not respected. Two, nerve conduction studies are not correctly performed, or criteria are not adhered to. Three, over-reliance on spinal fluid, protein mainly. And four, non-objective treatment response. Therefore, we paid a lot of attention to adjust criteria for other than typical CIDP forms to try to improve their specificity.
Thank you for this. Before we get into specifics, can you update us or tell us how you envision neurologists will be using this guidance in their clinical practice?
Well, an important new feature in the guideline are three flowcharts, which serve as a quick, easy, and practical reference for the clinician. Flowchart 1 covers the diagnostic criteria and the diagnostic categories of the different forms of CIDP. Flowchart 2 lists the clinical and laboratory red flags that suggest another diagnosis. And finally, flowchart 3 shows the treatment algorithms of the disease. Next, there are six tables that show at a glance the clinical and electrodiagnostic criteria, the differential diagnostic disorders, the investigations to be considered, and a summary of the criteria for diagnostic categories.
The guidelines includes significant changes, as you say, especially in the classification of the typical CIDP versus the different variants and definition of levels of diagnostic certainty. Can you be more analytical on these matters, please?
Certainly. Typical CIDP is the most common CIDP form. Other forms were labeled predominantly distal, asymmetric, pure motor, and pure sensory CIDP. We now propose the labels distal instead of predominantly distal, multifocal or focal instead of asymmetric, and motor CIDP and sensory CIDP instead of pure motor and pure sensory. We used to call these forms atypical CIDP, but they really are CIDP variants because each of these has well-defined characteristics. The CIDP umbrella is used because of a common denominator of inflammation and demyelination, but the etiology, pathophysiology for all these remain elusive. We used to have three diagnostic categories: definite, probable, and possible. Now it has become clear that the diagnostic accuracy of the nerve conduction criteria for probable and definite CIDP is virtually identical. And because of insufficient distinction between criteria for these, we have reduced the levels of diagnostic certainty to only two, which we labeled possible CIDP and CIDP. And we abandoned the adjective definite, since the absence of a diagnostic gold standard does not allow this.
Fantastic. Can you please take us through the clinical and electrodiagnostic criteria of CIDP and the different CIDP variants?
Well, clinical criteria for all forms include the pattern of weakness and sensory involvement, progression over at least 8 weeks, and decreased or absent deep tendon reflexes. For typical CIDP, the deficit is proximal and distal, motor and sensory, and in the forelimbs. CIDP variants, these are the same as in typical CIDP, but there is no proximal involvement in distal CIDP. There is involvement of two limbs in multifocal and only one limb in focal CIDP. There is no sensory involvement in motor CIDP and no motor involvement in sensory CIDP. Instead of having nerve conduction criteria for definite, probable, and possible CIDP, we now have criteria weakly supportive of demyelination for possible CIDP and strongly supportive for CIDP. They are based on well-defined deviation from normal reference values for 7 motor nerve conduction parameters, fulfillment of criteria of 1 conduction parameter in 2 nerves qualifies for the diagnosis of CIDP, and for possible CIDP if fulfilled in only 1 nerve. A new feature is the inclusion of sensory nerve conduction studies as an integral part of the nerve conduction criteria, and they are not supportive criteria anymore. Sensory conduction abnormalities in 2 nerves are required for all forms of CIDP except motor CIDP, where sensory conduction is normal. Specific criteria are proposed for possible CIDP, and these are not upgradable to CIDP. The specific criteria include slowing of sensory nerve conduction velocities and the Sorel sparing pattern, meaning that in the upper limb there is absence of the sensory action potential, sensory nerve action potential, and the Sorel nerve action potential is completely normal.
Thank you for these clarifications. So the task force had to make some difficult decisions regarding disorders not to be classified as CIDP. For example, a major advance in the field since the last guideline is the recognition of nodopathies and paraneuropathies as an important related set of disorders. Why these have not been included as CIDP variants?
Okay, let me explain. Autoimmune nodopathies were considered a subset of CIDP with a distal or typical phenotype, and this because of the clinical and electrodiagnostic criteria for CIDP were fulfilled. They are caused by antibodies against cell adhesion molecules that tightly secure the exoglial junction at the node of Ranvier and at the paranode, and these antibodies lead to detachment of the terminal myelin loops from the nodal and paranodal exolemma, with disappearance of the barrier between the sodium and the potassium channels and diffusion of the driving current that's necessary for action potential generation and saltatory conduction. The result is conduction slowing and conduction block, but there is no demyelination. Moreover, since these antibodies are of the IgG4 subtype, they cannot activate complement and do not cause inflammation. Therefore, the pathophysiology is very different from that of CIDP, and the response to proven treatments, IVIG in particular, is quite poor. On the other hand, more specific treatments are, for example, rituximab.
Thank you for these clarifications. Another disease that has not been classified as CIDP is the chronic inflammatory sensory polyradiculopathy, CISP. Can you tell us about it and how it differs from sensory CIDP and why this has not been included as a CIDP variant, please?
Well, CISP presents with ataxia and sensory loss. CISP has been considered a sensory CIDP variant in the former versions of the CIDP guideline because it fulfills clinical criteria for sensory CIDP. However, the task force decided to exclude CISP from the CIDP spectrum because it is not a neuropathy and nerve conduction studies are strictly normal. With a proximal sensory radiculopathy, probably inflammatory and demyelinating and treatment responsive, but it leaves the dorsal root ganglion neurons intact. This is why sensory nerve conduction studies are normal. There is some controversy because some feel that in some countries, the CIDP label would facilitate access to IVIG and its reimbursement. But scientifically spoken, it is not really something that belongs to the spectrum of CIDP for the reasons I just explained.
So the task force identified several criteria that can be used to support a CIDP diagnosis in patients meeting clinical criteria who do not fully meet the electrodiagnostic criteria. Can you please comment on the role of CSF examination in the MRI, please?
If the diagnosis of CIDP cannot be reached by clinical and nerve conduction criteria, then supportive criteria can be used to try to upgrade the diagnosis from possible CIDP to CIDP. To do so, two supportive criteria need to be fulfilled. There are four kinds of supportive criteria. One is objective response to treatment, a second, spinal fluid examination, a third, imaging, and a fourth, nerve biopsy. In cases of typical CIDP with motor conduction abnormalities that do not fulfill minimal criteria, a diagnosis of possible CIDP is now allowed if there is objective response to treatment and fulfillment of at least one other supportive criterion. That's really, we think, a step forward. Spinal fluid analysis is recommended to exclude other diagnoses, for instance, in cases of acute or subacute aggressive onset, or when infection or malignancy is suspected. However, it is also true that over-reliance on increased spinal fluid protein is prone to lead to misdiagnosis. This happens, for instance, in patients with diabetes and also in patients over age 50. As for imaging, we now advise the use of ultrasound and not only MRI, and this in adult patients at least. Ultrasound may even be superior for upper extremities since well-defined cutoffs for nerve enlargement are available for cervical roots, brachial plexus, and nerves. In addition, ultrasound has the advantage to be readily available in the clinic next to electrodiagnosis. The results are immediate and it is inexpensive. However, for the lumbosacral roots and plexuses, MRI remains important because ultrasound does not get access to these parts of the peripheral nervous system.
Thanks again for this. You mentioned nerve biopsy already, but it's a quite invasive procedure. When would you recommend a nerve biopsy to take place in patients where you suspect CIDP?
Well, nerve biopsy remains important, but only under specific circumstances. If the diagnosis cannot be confirmed by any criteria, if there is little or no response to treatment, or when there is suspicion of an alternative diagnosis. Now, the conditions to be fulfilled is that there need to be skilled surgeons, experienced pathologists with appropriate lab infrastructure. It should also be that the disease is severe enough to justify potential morbidity, and it should be discussed with the patient, and also the physician who requests the biopsy should understand that the accuracy of nerve biopsy is not always very good.
Thank you. It was very clear from you. Let's finish by talking about treatment approach in people with CIDP. What are the recommendations regarding first-line management, and how can we decide between the different treatments?
Well, let me start by saying that before you begin treatment, there are two preliminary conditions to be fulfilled. One should adhere to the diagnostic criteria, which is of utmost importance before considering to treat. treatment can be very expensive and can have significant side effects. Next, treat only if there is disability and impairment, and treat only if there is active disease, which means that objective worsening cannot be explained by axonal loss. For induction treatment, there are three proven effective modalities: corticosteroids, IVIG, and plasma exchange. Basically, corticosteroids and IVIG come first, and plasma exchange is often used if these do not work. Corticosteroids can be given daily, for example, prednisone 60 milligrams, or pulsed, oral or IV. Pulsed, then it can be dexamethasone 40 milligrams a day, orally for 4 days, or IV methylprednisolone 500 milligrams a day for 4 days. For IVIG, the typical starting dose is 2 grams per kilogram in 2 to 5 days. If not effective, one can continue with 1 gram per kilogram up to 5 times, or one can give a second dose of 2 grams per kilogram. Now, about preference, should one start with IVIG or corticosteroids? Well, there is no overall preference. Both work, not in all patients, but still, that is about similar. There is some reason to start with IVIG if you look for short-term effectiveness, and also if corticosteroids are contraindicated. And one of the variants that indeed are contraindication is motor CIDP. So in motor CIDP, corticosteroids should never be used first because this may worsen the clinical condition of the patient. For pulsed corticosteroids, one can choose if one is looking for long-term effectiveness, because what often happens is that patients can go into remission. Now, it is also the case for patients who cannot get IVIG, either because it's not available or because it's unaffordable. For maintenance treatment, one can use the same drugs. The typical scheme for IVIG is 1 gram per kilogram every 2 weeks. And now it's also possible to use subcutaneous immunoglobulin, SCIG, and there the dose is 0.2 to 0.4 grams per kilogram weekly. And this is as effective as IVIG. Whether to give SCIG or to continue with IVIG depends on patient preference. It is true that for SCIG, it's a little bit more difficult for the patient because it's more technical. But a big advantage is the freedom of the patient. He doesn't need to be hospitalized every 3 weeks anymore. Then if there is complete response, it is wise to periodically decrease the dose or the frequency of the treatment, and even so stop to see whether there is a remission or inactive disease. If the patient worsens after having stopped the treatment, then it's clear there is active disease. Now I should restart the treatment. If the response is only partial, then it should be wise to consider increasing the dose or the frequency or to combine treatments.
Thank you, Professor van der Berg, for the very clear summary of the treatment approach. Is there anything else on the new guideline that you would like to add for our audience?
Yes, for the diagnostic workup, of course, there's not enough time to talk about all the details, but for the laboratory evaluation, I just want to stress that it's very important to look for monoclonal gammopathy, because in the differential diagnosis is, for instance, are the patients with the distal variant who may be having paraprotein, especially IgM, and sometimes or often these patients do have antibodies against anti-MAG, myelin-associated glycoprotein. If that's the case, then there is then the treatment is a little bit different. And also, this is not CIDP. Then there are patients who may have an IgA or an IgG monoclonal protein. And these patients may have POOMS, which is a special syndrome, which is also completely different from CIDP. And it's important to make a diagnosis from the start, because otherwise it takes a long time to get to the right diagnosis, and the patient may get not get the right workup for having a good diagnosis. Then, of course, it's also important, if necessary, to look for autoimmune adapity and to test for antibodies in these patients. Ideally, this should be done in all patients suspected of having CIDP, but in practice for the moment, that's impossible because there are not enough labs who can do the test in a good way and quickly.
Great. Thank you for these tips. It was my pleasure to host this podcast. Thank you, Professor van der Berg, for your time and the very, very clear answers.
Thank you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.